I'm going to hand over for the final panel of the day on nuclear innovation and proliferation to Richard White from AWE. I'm sorry he's not in your program. We didn't have him confirmed until the last minute and we went to print without him. So Richard White.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me on the mic? Okay, thank you. Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for the introduction. I'm Richard White from AWE. I manage a program of geopolitical and strategic analysis in support of the UK deterrent at AWE. Today, I am officially old. Chris Grosvenor mentioned earlier that we have fresh young things and perhaps more mature views. But this is actually the first time that I've chaired a session at Pony rather than taking the daunting walk up to the lectern. So I'm delighted to do so. And actually, AWE is delighted to sponsor this project, which aims to have a broad, cross-generational and open debate. The last session that we have this afternoon is about nuclear innovation and proliferation. So it's perhaps the most technical session that we have today. The panel that we have, I've actually heard them all speak before in various guises. Some at the Pony conference on the boat last summer. Some at 2 o'clock in the morning after a few ales at US Strategic Command, where the opinions were perhaps a little bit less constrained. So on my left, we have Matthew Gill, who's a doctoral candidate at the University of Manchester, who will be talking to us about safeguard and protection requirements for Generation 4 nuclear reactor systems. On my immediate right, we have John Adams, who is from Systems Assessment at AWE, who's going to be looking at the limitations of intrinsic proliferation resistance barriers. It's not his day job, it's something for which he studied for his MSc and his PhD in the past. And further on the right, we have Hugh Chalmers, who's a nuclear analyst at Royal United Services Institute, who will be telling us about the proliferation risks of laser isotope separation technology. I'd like to remind everybody that all presentations are on the record, however, questions are not. And I'd like also to remind the panel that it is us, between the good people of the audience and their canapes later, so let's hopefully stick to time. A point on the questions that we will have subsequently. There is quite a lot of experience within the audience that we want to tap into. So if you want to respond directly to a question that's been asked on the other side of the room, please do so. Thank you very much. And first presentation, Matthew Gill.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm Matthew Gill. I'm currently at the University of Manchester studying my PhD in sodium fast reactors and fuel cycle systems with Professor Timothy Abram and Greg Butler. This presentation isn't really about that. This is about something else that's kind of fallen out of some work I'm doing at the moment between the University of Manchester and NNL, writing a DEC report about UK re-engagement strategies for Generation 4 reactor systems. This is not part of that body of work. This is just something else that's kind of fallen out of it, so I thought I'd put it together for the purpose of this. It's going to be a short background and overview, highlighting some of the specific points, and I'm happy to discuss anything in more detail further, but if you want to talk about reprocessing techniques or reactor designs, I'd probably do it in private rather than the discussion session. So I'm going to go over the Generation 4 reactor concepts, why they're being taken forward under the Generation 4 International Forum, their advantages, the different technology readiness levels of them, and their potential contribution to world energy scenarios. Then the second half of it is going to be looking more in more detail a bit at the proliferation aspects and their fuel cycles, and how this affects non-state actors and physical protection aspects, and state actors and proliferation concerns in that respect, before concluding. So there are six Generation 4 reactor systems, which I've grouped broadly into thermal reactors, fast reactors, and molten salt reactors, which are a bit of a special case in using a thorium fuel cycle, which is a bit different. More detail, the thermal reactors. There's the supercritical water reactor, which is more of an extension of current PWRs, and the idea being having greater thermal efficiency. The very high temperature reactor, which has got a very high outlet temperature, which is aimed at process heat applications, has a very robust fuel, which is intrinsically quite good for safety aspects and proliferation. Considering getting the material out of these fuels is pretty hard. If you can see the picture of the TRISO particles, which are embedded in big pebbles or prismatic blocks. I'm not really going to talk about supercritical water reactors. I'm just going to group them all together in sort of thermal reactors. And there's the fast wrap systems. These have been taken forward based on sustainability concerns and being able to use prolonged fission resources, fissile resources, well into the next millennium, and also their potential to minimize the burden on a repository and the intergenerational nature of waste. They require a closed fuel cycle, which is why they're an inherent proliferation concern and interesting to look at. In particular, there are three fast reactor systems, a sodium reactor, which is a very near-term design and very well understood, the lead-cooled fast reactor, which is aimed also, as well as sort of commercial use, at regional deployment and remote deployment, due to the fact that the lead has this great property of being able to freeze and making it sort of a big block, which you can't really do much with. And also, the coolant doesn't react with water, unlike sodium reactors. And finally, there's the gas reactor, which is the least developed of them all. It has a very hard neutron spectrum, which has benefits in terms of breeding or burning long-lived waste. And it also has a very high outlet temperature. So it's also anticipated to be a more long-term idea looking at sustainability as well as process heat applications, a sort of a step after the very high-temperature reactor. And there's the thorium reactor, which is a little bit different, the molten salt reactor. I'm not really an expert in this area, but it's worth bringing up. I'm just going to gloss over some of the more important factors. It uses the thorium fuel cycle instead of the uranium-plutonium fuel cycle. Liquid fuels has the potential to be either a fast or a thermal reactor. It has a high outlet temperature, and there are several designs which orientate themselves around this one or two fluid design, where you can either have sort of a breeder blanket of the fluid around the outside and the actual material on the inside, which you sort of take out the fission products or the fissile material and then store it. And this reactor in itself also requires a closed fuel cycle, either with online reprocessing or with batch fuel reprocessing, and either taking out fission products and adding in some more fissile or fertile material, and or removing the protactinium, letting that decay into the fissile material and putting it back into it. So something that's come out of the report that we've been writing is the technology readiness levels of these different reactor systems. Two of them are at the state of being more of a conceptual design. Some of them have been demonstrated on a more small-scale basic system, like molten salt reactors or lead-cooled reactors. Some, like the sodium reactor, have been developed and deployed worldwide on a small scale, and some have been even more successful, like the HTR-type reactors, which, with two outlet temperature range, have been deployed rather successfully. And these have different, in the long term, if you want them for the world energy usage, you have either sustainability interests, minimizing waste interests, process heat, or regional or remote deployment, and they have different aspects in those respects. So on to nitty-gritty in terms of proliferation. You can see up there there's not the clearest, there's a long line, which is the ratio of plutonium-239 to the total plutonium in material that comes out of a reactor. You can see that, as a general term, is with higher burn-up of reactors, you get a much lower ratio of plutonium-239 to total plutonium, and you want it to be over about 93% for it to be really good for a weapon. So Magnox, the stuff that we had to begin with, is between the sort of 70 and 80 mark, and then when you get to PWRs, you get below the 70 mark, below the 60 mark, and as higher burn-up, you get it lower and lower, and when you start to recycle plutonium into that, you get the isotopics being even worse. So you get the higher isotopes of plutonium up to 240, 241, and so on. With VHTRs, which aim to have a much higher burn-up, these are going to be further down to the left-hand side, whereas with fast reactors, the fuel itself isn't the important factor. It's if you're using breeder blankets, where you get them way off to the right-hand side of the scale. Not sure if you can see it very clearly, but there's a picture I took out of a book which shows you the Indian prototype fast breeder reactor. And this shows you the ratio of plutonium-239 to total plutonium over effective full power days. And you can see how it slowly declines off, because with burn-up, you get higher isotopes of plutonium in there. And one thing that's important is that the refueling for this reactor, due to certain limitations, is done on every 185 effective full power days. And that's where the little red line is. So that means you get plutonium, but a very, very high concentration of 239, way above what you would need to make a weapon, which is why fast reactors are such a big concern. On the other side, there's molten salt reactors and thorium fuel cycle. This is something that requires, if you're going to make a weapon with uranium-233, you require it to be very, very pure. The ingress of things like, or the production of things like uranium-232 causes problems in terms of a poisoning effect, the thermal degradation of explosives because it's very highly active, and worker dose. There is a limitation on this, but in the short time I was looking for papers, I found a few different values depending on different things. I'm not quite sure what the limiting factor is. I'm sure someone can tell you, but it's very, very small in the range of parts per million. So in terms of the fuel cycle, there's the uranium-plutonium cycle, and this is the way that you produce plutonium in the breeder blankets, and through uranium having a capture and then subsequent decays. And then when you get up to the plutonium-239, the last part has a very short half-life. And if you want to get plutonium for a weapon, you want to have something that's got a high concentration of 239 and then extract the plutonium from that using something like a Purex cycle that we've had experience with. Alternatively, if you're using a thorium-uranium cycle and you want to get hold of fissile material for a weapon, you're going to take out the protactinium. This is because between the protactinium and the final point, the uranium-233 that you want, there is a much longer half-life, and the decay's around the half-life's around 27 days, which means if you extract the protactinium, and you if you extract the protactinium and you just leave it rest somewhere, you have a very pure U-233 without any 232, which stops it being weapons usable. And then when it comes to thermal reactors, you don't have really a big concern because there's no inherent reprocessing with them, and if there is, it's not really weapons usable material, so there aren't that many real problems. The way that these materials become less useful for weapons is when you have higher burn-ups or you leave them in reactors for longer. There's a little diagram in the bottom right, which you can't really see, but there's lots of different interactions which gives you other components in there. So higher isotopes of plutonium, different isotopes of uranium, like 235, 232, which you can't extract out, which limit the weapon's usability of the material. So in terms of physical protection and intrinsic barriers that prevent non-state actors. There's fast reactor aspects. To try and stop this, you can use the inherent barriers such as fuels which are hard to reprocess and separate. So this includes things like using carbide fuels, which are much harder to extract, or things like metallic fuels, which have inherent issues if you start to dissolve them in nitric acid. You can try and use, that's heterogeneous, that should be homogeneous, homogeneous reprocessing techniques like the Ganex process or pyroreprocessing methodologies to make sure that you have minor actinides in your plutonium. That makes it self-protecting to some extent, and it also ensures that in your facilities there's no separated plutonium stream, which is good if you have non-state actors trying to steal things. In fast reactors, you could try and not use radial breeder blankets and have high residence times of these materials, and this will make them less weapons usable by having higher isotopes, which make it less useful. And also trying to minimize the transport of these materials so there's less potential for people to divert them, and you can see where these materials are all the time. In terms of molten salt reactors, I'm trying not to go into that in too much detail, but you want to try not to have an isolated amount of protactinium. This can be done through different reprocessing methodologies and not having it on its own. If anyone's really interested in this, there's a good review of some of the techniques in this Oak Ridge paper at the bottom. So in terms of non-state actors and generation four systems, they'd have to be very sophisticated if they wanted to make a weapon out of these materials. Gun-type devices, the material's not really that effective for it. And implosion devices, which you'd require, are very sophisticated, and you'd have to get a device from elsewhere. In this respect, you have a lot of barriers to prevent to producing such a weapon, including acquiring the materials, developing the device, and successfully separating it out. When it comes to risk of different generation four reactors, the bog-standard fast reactors are obviously the worst because you have a much lower level of activity, so it's easier to extract the materials, and also the extraction routes are much easier to get plutonium out compared to thorium molten salt reactors. And then there's thermal reactors, which are rather intrinsically safe. In terms of state actors and proliferation resistance, extrinsic barriers are the most important ones, as I'm sure we've heard a lot about today. Materials measurements to focus on non-destructive and in-situ testing to make sure what is actually there is there. Passive detection to see if materials have been removed and surveillance. All these aspects can, however, be got around with clever geometry and little tricks and using things like shielding. So the important factor is inspection. And this becomes more of a problem when you start to have regional deployment of reactors and remote reactors because you have a lot more facilities that you need to see, a lot more that you need to inspect. And in this respect, you're going to spread your resources much more thinly, and it's going to take longer, there's going to be a longer time to, or you're going to require more staff, to detect any diversion. Intrinsic barriers are good at trying to help with this, but intrinsic barriers are not going to stop someone completely. They're just putting in more barriers which will slow someone down, increasing the material that you require to divert it in terms of a state, and the processes that to make the weapons, the material more weapons usable. So in terms of a sophisticated state, which has got one of these reactor systems and the techniques to use them, as well as understanding all the reprocessing technology, this isn't going to be a significant barrier that's going to stop them. It's far more useful in molten salt reactors, where you can help with this, more so than in fast reactor systems. So in summary, I think I'm making good time. Physical protection aspects, not a big issue in terms of non-state adapters. They can't really use a lot of these materials that will be produced, and let alone have the technology to use them. So there aren't very good ways of preventing non-state adapters without having to go down the route of having very complicated nuclear fuel cycles. In terms of proliferation resistance and state adapters, these are more intrinsic, more dependent on extrinsic factors. The intrinsic factors do make a difference and make it more difficult, but do not prevent it. The extrinsic factors are needed on its own to detect material in the state case of people wanting to use facilities overtly or covertly. Inspection is the biggest requirement of this, and if you have a large deployment of regional reactors worldwide, it's going to put a much bigger burden on inspection and cause problems. In these sorts of scenarios, it turns out that things like enrichment are going to be more of a concern than extraction technologies for countries. So overall, there's one last point that I'd like to point out, that if you've watched the Kirk Sorensen video, molten salt reactors and thorium fuel cycles are not proliferation-proof. They're intrinsically better than fast reactor systems, but they're not proliferation-proof. It's something I'd like to highlight because it's something a lot of people I've spoken to recently don't seem to quite grasp. And I'll say thank you and ask for questions, but hold until later.
Thank you very much, Matthew. Are there any detailed questions or points of information on what you've heard at all? Let me clarify. Okay, thank you very much. I find it very interesting. I find it very interesting. What is the threshold of what would we consider safe against what a non-state actor would consider safe? And maybe there is a difference in a perception there. Perhaps that's something we can discuss later. But thank you very much. John Adams from AWE.
Okay, thanks, Richard. First of all, I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak at today's conference. My talk is on limitations of intrinsic proliferation resistance barriers. So this is the contents of my talk. I suppose I'm quite lucky, really, because I'm getting to talk on something that's a hobby of mine, really, something that I don't do as a day job, and so I can pretty much choose the things that interest me. October 2011, there was quite an interesting Royal Society report issued, Fuel Stewardship in a Nuclear Renaissance, which rather interested me. So that's going to form sort of the context, really, for my presentation. I'll be talking about thorium as a nuclear fuel, because the Royal Society report mentions thorium, some of the advantages of using thorium, and addressing a question as to whether or not it's proliferation resistant. I'll also be looking at what we call radiation barriers, so self-protection. And I'll be examining those radiation barriers with respect to dose criteria and what these radiation effects can actually do to stop a non-state actor. And finally, I'll draw some conclusions. Fuel Stewardship in a Nuclear Renaissance was a Royal Society science report. It's examined the potential of new technologies and government best practices to make the nuclear fuel cycle more secure and proliferation resistant. It was launched by the Right Honourable Chris Hulme MP, who was the Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change. It was really organised by a working group of experts, and they were established to sort of oversee the programme. Also, it was independent as well. It was funded centrally by the UK as a strategic programme fund. So within the report, it featured a number of sort of chapters, including stewardship challenges, talking about the changing nature of the nuclear industry now. The nuclear industry is well over 60 years old. There was a section on proliferation resistance of spent fuel management, which is in italics there, because I'm going to go on to talk about that, and it finished with some recommendations. So moving on to thorium, which is an area of particular interest. So there was a talk earlier, and I remember a quote from that talk, we must ensure that terrorists never acquire a nuclear weapon. So when it comes to proliferation resistance, for this presentation. I'm really talking about illicit procurement of material by non-state actors. And this fellow, Carlo Rubbia, quite an eminent gentleman. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1984 for his work in particle physics, has gone on record as stating that the breeding reaction on thorium is largely immune from proliferation risks. So that's quite a statement to make, particularly when you consider how esteemed Carlo Rubbia is. So first of all, I'm going to investigate that claim. So before I do, thorium has other advantages besides from being supposedly proliferation resistant. It's 3 to 4 times more abundant than uranium, for example. So if you're in a country with lots of thorium, such as India, it's very useful. Thorium reactors generally run at high temperatures, so they are generally have greater safety margins. And there are plutonium burning options for thorium reactors as well. So if you wish, you can reduce your plutonium stockpile. But in red there, it's a disadvantage. So largely an improving technology. The Indians, for example, who are quite far ahead in this technology, might have a thorium reactor by 2020. So we're certainly not there yet with thorium reactors. So let's examine this proliferation-resistant claim. In terms of fuel, well, most conventional reactors require uranium-235, enriched to about 3% as fuel, and uranium-235 can be weaponized if it's enriched enough. So I guess that's a proliferation concern. In a thorium reactor, the fuel is generally thorium-232, and thorium-232 by itself is not fissile. So a simple argument, which perhaps Carlo was trying to make, is that thorium-232 fuel is proliferation resistant. However, it's worth noting that many thorium reactor designs do require fissile material to start up. So from that point of view, it's not proliferation resistant. So now let's look at the products. So starting with a PWR again, well, the proliferation concerns there are the unburnt fuel and the plutonium. For a thorium reactor, you have leftover thorium, the fission products, and also uranium-233, which we saw in Matt's presentation previously. So thorium is essentially fertile. You can breed uranium-233 from thorium, and uranium-233 can be weaponized. Therefore, simple argument, thorium spent fuel is not proliferation resistant. However, a question mark is there because one could argue this is a simplification, and then there is an argument that fuel is self-protecting. So the next part of my talk will be on what we actually mean by self-protection. So the Royal Society report has a section on enhancing radiation barriers. It includes thorium in that because the isotope of uranium-232 that's always produced in conjunction with uranium-233 emits a very high energy gamma ray, which assists in the self-protection of the spent fuel. There are other radiation barriers, such as in Eurex, where you extract uranium only, leaving the plutonium protected by the fission products. And there's fuel doping, for example, with protactinium-231, which works on the same principle as the thorium there. And there are other sort of barriers as well, such as COEX, which the Royal Society reports mentions, which leaves uranium and plutonium in situ and pyroprocessing. But I'll be talking about the radiation barriers. So the intrinsic proliferation resistance of spent fuel is based on the dose received from ionizing radiations from that fuel. And the current recommendation for self-protection, and I reference IMSERC that was mentioned earlier in this today, IMSERC 225, is about 1 gray per hour. Now, in the West, we're very conservative when it comes to radiation dose. For comparison, the annual UK occupational exposure limit is about 20 milligray per year. The average UK radiation worker receives 1.5 milligray per year, and you only get about 0.05 milligray if you receive an X-ray, right? So the recommended limit for self-protection is over 400,000 times the UK occupational exposure limit. So way, way above what dose limits are in the West and in the UK. So it does seem at first glance to be quite a stringent sort of dose criteria, one gray per hour. But then if you look at some of the research on radiation effects, they characterize radiation effects in terms of an LD50, which means lethal dose 50. So that's the immediate dose of radiation you would need to receive to give you a 50% chance of death within 2 months. And that's about 4.5 gray. So that's 4.5 times the dose that you would receive in an hour based on current recommendations. It's also important to note, when considering radiation effects, that the dose rate is very important. So the 4.5 gray is assuming you get all that dose in one go. If you received 4.5 gray spread over, say, a whole year, your chances are far better than if you received an instantaneous dose. And there isn't really that much data out there on getting high doses over a year, but it's a known effect. So that 4.5 gray is likely to itself to be rather conservative, maybe. So these sorts of considerations led Oak Ridge National Laboratory to propose a security-based definition of self-protection. And it's stated here, the incapacitation inflicted upon a recipient from inherent radiation emissions in a time frame that prevents the recipient from completing an intended task. So in other words, you don't just receive a dose, do what you've got to do with the spent fuel, and then maybe survive or maybe die afterwards. You actually keel over while you're tampering with the fuel, right? That's what the security-based definition means. And they put it at 100 gray per hour, so that's 100 times what's recommended in the IMCIRC back there. And they reckon that's the level that significantly affected performance of the perpetrator and offered limited, no, they say limited, even they don't say guaranteed, limited self-protection in the range of minutes, and it has 100% fatality rate. So a security-based definition. So what does this actually mean for a fuel assembly? Well, I couldn't find in literature a thorium reactor fuel assembly, so we've got to make do with a dose rate from a PWR fuel assembly. So you've got dose rate along the y-axis there and cooling time along the x-axis. So the red line at the top is the Oak Ridge 100 gray per hour recommendation. And if you believe that, then you're self-protecting out to about 5 years, if you take the 1 meter from fuel line, that is. And if you take the 1 gray per hour recommendation, which is the IMCIRC, the IAEA recommendation, then you're self-protecting out beyond 50 years. So are you self-protecting or not? So in the open cycle, or UREX, which is this standard PWR assembly example, then we've seen that you're self-protecting between 5 to 50 years, or greater than 50 years, depending on what dose criteria you use. For thorium, I haven't seen a lot of good data on thorium fuel assemblies, as mentioned, but it depends on burn-up and the half-life of your uranium-232, which is about 69 years. That emits a high-energy gamma ray, which will offer you an extra degree of self-protection. As mentioned, the dose criteria is very important when considering self-protection. I think it's important to mention here that we've got to avoid mirror imaging when considering what dose rate to use. For example, we saw in one of the earlier slides that in the UK we have very low dose rates for occupational exposure limits. So we might think that a 1 gray per hour is good enough to deter. But if you're a non-state actor willing to take a dose, willing to take a chance, even willing to martyr yourself, then 1 gray per hour is not enough, and you've got to adopt the 100 gray per hour criteria. So I think generally, when it comes to making policy decisions such as these, we tend to err on the conservative side. So if you want to be conservative with your self-protecting measures, then you've got to adopt the 100 gray per hour criteria. So this means you're really looking at potentially making your fuel more radioactive in order to ensure that it's self-protecting. And there's an issue with political acceptability here, because from a social science point of view, the thing that most people are unhappy about or afraid of is the radiation from the spent fuel. So it's very unlikely you're going to be able to sell that. So for that reason, I think that the advantages of self-protection for reactors have been massively oversold. And it's there, it's a consideration, but it shouldn't be a primary consideration when considering proliferation resistance. So I guess that's a bit negative. So we saw an excellent talk earlier on some of the physical barriers to proliferation. There are other technical proliferation barriers mentioned in the Royal Society report, which I'll briefly go over here, such as optimised system design. So this is minimising the amount of time that your fuel is exposed. There's spiking. So this is, in Matt's presentation, he showed you some plots of the isotopics. So you can actually change the isotopics of your fuel to make it less weaponizable. There's inert matrix fuel, so this is removing the fertile uranium-238 altogether in favour of some inert matrix, so that you're not breeding plutonium. But then there are the unknown unknowns. These are the things that we just haven't explored yet. In terms of the unknown unknowns, I think it's important here to recognise that the UK's role in the development of nuclear technology has really been declining over the last few decades. As shown here in this plot of R&D workforce against time, and you can see we've gone from about 9,000 to about 500. You know what, there's probably one or two things out there that we haven't considered, but we haven't been putting the research into it, so we're not going to know about it. Anyway, let's draw some conclusions. I don't believe thorium is an option for the UK. There's no real economic driver to use thorium. Uranium prices have remained low for a good time now, plus it's an unproven technology. One thing's for sure, and this agrees with Matt's conclusion as well, thorium is not intrinsically proliferation resistant. If anything, it's quite the opposite, but that's another talk. There is intrinsic resistance offered by radiation barriers is a factor, but not a strong one. And if you're going to adopt self-protection, then adopt the Oak Ridge National Laboratory recommendation of 100 gray per hour and not the 1 gray per hour recommendation, because that's a security-based definition that will offer you proper self-protection. And finally, the UK's role in fission R&D has been declining. I think it really needs enhanced support. Most importantly, I think the UK needs to be able to contribute to the responsible stewardship of a global nuclear renaissance by contributing technically to discussions internationally, and we're not going to be able to do that unless we fund our research. So, with that, I'd like to acknowledge John Nash for his helpful discussions on dose criteria from AWE, and ask if there are any technical questions on my presentation.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, John. Quite a lot of concepts in there, some of which are necessarily going to conflict. For example, I've not heard the concepts of Right Honourable and Chris Hune in the same sentence recently. But thank you very much. Final speaker of the... Oh, OK, fine.
It's just a technical point on dose rates of thorium-uranium fuels from a PWR. In Kang and von Hippel's work of 2001, the typical discharge burn-up is 70 gigawatt days per tonne. The doses attributed are about 130 millisieverts per hour, rising up to 380 millisieverts per hour for a spent fuel assembly. So again, well under the one gray per hour lower.
So you're saying that's too optimistic?
Sorry?
You're saying that's too optimistic?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay. Final speaker of the afternoon is Hugh Chalmers from RUSI. Thank you.
Hi there, everybody. Thanks for bearing with us. I don't want to keep you guys from your drinks for too long, but as kind of UK Pony coordinator, I just want to quickly thank Philippa and David over at Cabo and NRC, and most importantly, Ben, who's right at the back. He's going to be doing microphone duties without his help. This probably would never have happened, so I've got to thank him quite a lot. Find me afterwards for that pint that I owe you. But anyway, to the presentation. Just, where is this? Okay, yeah, so I essentially want to talk about uranium enrichment and specifically laser isotope separation. Now, uranium enrichment has been a thorn in the side of a lot of proliferation regimes for quite some time. If you were to look at this little innocuous blue roofed building over there, that's actually the center of North Korea's enrichment program, which people were looking for ages. They knew it was somewhere, but it was only actually revealed when they invited somebody in to come and see it. In contrast, producing weapons-grade plutonium is a lot harder to really hide. This is what remains of what people thought was a plutonium-producing reactor in Syria before Israel spotted it pretty quickly and unfortunately blew it up quite fast. So obviously, uranium enrichment seems to be the desired approach nowadays. Now, one of these techniques is laser isotope separation. It's been around for a really, really long time. The first experiments in laser isotope separation were actually around the 1960s, 1970s. And in 1991, the US National Academy of Sciences did actually do a big assessment on the proliferation risks of laser isotope separation and decided that for anything but the most advanced states around the world, it was far too complicated. No one was really going to bother when you can pursue centrifuge enrichment programs. But obviously, things have changed a little bit since 1991. We've kind of gotten used to the fact that you can get fairly advanced, quite powerful, and quite tunable lasers for relatively cheap. And indeed, only last year, they've licensed in the US the first actual kind of production-scale laser enrichment plant for the commercial production of fuel. So obviously, a lot of the kind of technical barriers to it have really been overcome in the last 20 years. And this means that, you know, we've got to start taking this a little bit more seriously now. And people have been. They've been coming up with some fairly novel attempts to really mitigate against the proliferation risks of laser enrichment. And from what I've heard today, some of these attempts can actually have some really weird side effects, I'd say, on a nuclear endeavor, basically. And so to get started, I'm going to do a very, very brusque kind of course introduction to laser isotope separation. I'm no laser physicist, but I'll try and do this quickly and cleanly. The first is atomic vapor separation, where basically you generate a vapor of just pure uranium atoms, obviously with desirable and undesirable isotopes in there. You expose them to a carefully tuned laser, which ionizes the desirable isotopes and leaves the other ones unaffected. And that means you can remove them just with an electrostatic charge. The second one is molecular separation, where rather than having a stream of uranium atoms, you operate a stream of uranium hexafluoride, which is the same stuff they use for centrifuges. And what happens is that the laser selectively disrupts the molecules of uranium-235, removing basically one of the fluorine atoms. And that means what's left over creates a uranium petrofluoride dimer, sorry for the technical talk, which is easily removed by chemistry, essentially. So you can just pull that out quite simply. And the one that they're using in the US is called the Silex process, which is actually quite confidential. I can't tell you any of the details for it. I don't actually know them myself. But people think that essentially it doesn't break the molecules, it just disrupts them in a certain way that makes them removable. I think a guy called Frank Eerkens thinks that this is what you can do is you disrupt the molecules and therefore they condense at different rates in a big supersonic jet. So anyway, that's the technical stuff over and done with. On to the proliferation risks. Essentially, a declared and known laser isotope separation plant isn't a massive, massive problem. The IAEA has a lot of experience dealing with uranium hexafluoride processes before. This is what they're going to be using in Silex. So if the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the IAEA can work together on this new plant, they'll get quite a lot of experience in safeguarding this thing, so I think that'll be fine. Avalis, the atomic vapor, might be a little different because it's quite new. No one's really managed to kind of bring it up to a scale where the IAEA is really up to speed on it. The real problem is actually a covert or undeclared hidden laser enrichment program. This is what everybody's worrying about, like North Korea's enrichment program or Iran's enrichment program, because really, at least 27 states have investigated this. There's a broad base of knowledge out there. Everybody knows about it. A really, really small-scale plant essentially, with a very low material input, can actually produce one bomb's worth of HEU. Now, this is theoretically speaking. And most importantly, this is what I want to get into, is that laser enrichment research and development, or like a hypothetical research and development program, doesn't actually give traditional detection mechanisms much of an opportunity to work. It's actually quite hard for traditional detection mechanisms to spot this type of thing if you're trying to hide it hard. So this is essentially a kind of a generic covert laser enrichment R&D pathway, which I picked up from an IAEA document. Starts first with spectroscopy, where you'd take a small amount of uranium and you'd analyze how it behaves underneath the laser. So you're really just exploring the characteristics of this laser-uranium interaction. And you take that information and you pick a laser, basically. You'd find a laser that can deliver the requirements. You'd acquire it somehow, either buy it or build it yourself, and you have to test it, make sure that it works as you desired. Then, as a separate thing, you need to work out how you're going to get this uranium passing by the laser. So you have to have, you know, material processing techniques. So you would have to produce the feed material, you have to run it past the laser, you have to be able to separate the product and the waste streams and things like that. So obviously in the case of AVLIS, that's atomic vapors. And then you need to basically wrap it all up into one workable system. So you take the laser tech and the material processing and you'd combine it and, you know, develop it into cascades and, you know, commission the whole thing, make sure it runs. So traditional detection mechanisms, I might have to dash through this one a little bit quickly, but I've done it in terms of input. So first of all, you'll need uranium. That's covered by IAEA comprehensive safeguards agreements to a limited extent and to a greater extent, the additional protocol and obviously export controls. Secondly, you need the equipment to make it run. Again, mainly export controls. As Dan said in his presentation, you can spot a covert program if you're trying to divert past export controls. Then you also have the expertise, the actual kind of human knowledge that goes into it. With the IAEA additional protocol, you need to declare a lot of your fuel cycle research and development, so they might have knowledge of who's who, but also open source intelligence and, to a lesser extent, member states can provide the IAEA with human intelligence to really identify these people and what they're doing. And finally, you need the facility to make it run. Again, IAEA additional protocol, you've got satellite imagery analysis, you've got bigger declarations, there's more clues there, and again, human intelligence. For instance, the Iran Fordo centrifuge plant was revealed mainly by human intelligence. But if I take these back to the actual program, the research and development program, there's a couple of problems here, because with spectroscopy, this is really common work. Everybody does spectroscopy all over the place. You can integrate this type of thing very easily into university departments around the world. You do need uranium to do it, but you don't really need that much. You don't need a large quantity of uranium. You can do it with less than an effective kilogram of uranium. And you don't actually have to have the separation grade lasers. You're just testing this material. So the lasers that you do it with wouldn't necessarily be controlled. Secondly, the laser tech, you don't need uranium at all for this bit. You can have a laser department in a university that doesn't go anywhere near uranium. They just get the information from the spectroscopy, and they can sit there and test lasers. And while a lot of the export control lists do cover some of these lasers, they do need to be regularly updated as laser tech develops. And one thing I noticed is that there's actually kind of a home hobbyist laser community out there. You can go online and you can see people making lasers out of homemade kit. And there will come a point where essentially if you're a trained individual, you've been around the world, you've been to, let's say, MIT, you've been to Cambridge, you've been to Oxford, can make them yourself, basically. With the material processing, basically, while many of the producers that you'd need are controlled, such things like electron guns to make atomic vapors, there are kind of lower tech solutions that are quite feasible, like laser ablation and things like that that you can use. And in the case of molecular laser isotope separation, whilst you do need uranium hexafluoride to be able to test this system, you can use depleted uranium. It doesn't have to be enriched to any level. And obviously, the international controls for depleted uranium are far, 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 far lower than they are for enriched. So that's a bit of a problem. And then when you actually want to bring it all together to make this into a system, you can test the entire system without using uranium again. You can use a whole bunch of hexafluoride products. I think if I can flick through quickly, sulfur hexafluoride, you can use molybdenum hexafluoride. So again, you can test this thing and commission it without actually having to use any uranium hexafluoride. Another interesting point is with optical fiber technology, you can actually have the laser in a different building to the material processing building. So it might not all be in just one big room. They can actually spread it out quite easily. Or, well, maybe not. I'm not an optical fiber expert, so someone can correct me on that if I'm wrong. And in general, there are some really important points about this. Not one of these research and development stages is unique. You know, these are all dual use, every single one of them. So you can complicate matters when you're trying to identify it, because it's quite legitimate to have other isotope separation programs going on. Each stage can be carried out in different locations. In Korea's case, Republic of Korea, the spectroscopy was done by 4 separate university departments. The laser technology was done by 6 separate university departments, all spread around, and they all had little packets of work to do. So trying to spot the bigger picture was quite hard in that case. Finally, as I said at the start, when you bring this thing together, the footprint is actually going to be really, really small. You don't need to have too much power input. You don't have to have much infrastructure sitting around. So again, it becomes quite hard to spot the final facility. And in theory, now I emphasize this is in theory, that an advanced program could actually take less than 1 kilogram of depleted uranium and bring that up to weapons grade. And that's quite significant, because a lot of work is focused on taking, you know, 2% enriched uranium, 5% enriched uranium, and bring it up, but not from depleted uranium. So that's going to be a real problem. And to really mitigate against these risks, I've kind of identified 3 main approaches, the first of which is the traditional one, where you strengthen the IAEA monitoring and you really try and exert much more rigorous export control. So the first would be universal adoption of the additional protocol, and the second one is more rigorous implementation. But as we've heard today, I'm not quite sure how much we can really rely on this. If you were just to really force rigorous export controls, then you could start stifling industries. It becomes kind of unfeasible, to be honest. It's not necessarily the best approach. Another interesting approach is to actually start looking at the people behind it. As we talked about in the second panel, the kind of the intangibles, which, you know, it also has its problems. S.A. Erickson from Lawrence Livermore said that an alternative source of clues would be to actually monitor the training, work experience, and scientific interchange of nationals of a possible proliferating nation. Now, this is something that I might have to extend to the floor in the question and answer session, but to me, that seems to have some fairly important implications for the spread of kind of scientific development. If you know that you're being monitored for everything that you do, if you have to kind of write down everybody's name, what they learn, what they know, who they've met, so that if they were to go to Iran, if they were to go to anywhere around the world, you could kind of keep watch on them. I'm not quite sure, but if that was the case for me, I probably wouldn't want to go to America to go and study if I was going to be the subject of human intelligence for the rest of my academic career. So I don't know. I mean, I'd say that has some fairly important side effects, really, for Endeavour. And the last one, this is my personal pet peeve, to be honest. When the Silex plant was being licensed in America, a bunch of non-proliferation experts came out and produced a huge collection of papers. They signed petitions to basically make the NRC do a huge proliferation risk assessment before they licensed it. And a very large part of that was the idea that if you actually allow this place to be built, the Silex process proves to be extremely useful, it works very well, then you're going to encourage would-be proliferators around the world to actually start investigating it. And so implicit in that approach, they were suggesting that if a proliferation risk assessment were to say, this process is too good, people are going to start seeing this as a viable route to a nuclear weapon, then you should not license it. To me, I mean, that, first of all, it doesn't really seem fair, because you're denying the licensing of a process that's actually proven to be quite effective and could be financially viable. And second of all, I'm not quite sure it'll even be effective, because for most would-be proliferants out there, what they really see is that they see a giant multinational conglomerate like GE Hitachi investing huge amounts of money into a process, which may not get licensed. But if I was them, I'd say that's obviously a viable technology. I don't think GE Hitachi would go to the effort of getting it to the licensing stage without them being pretty sure that it was workable technology. So I think a lot of these approaches towards mitigating the risks of laser isotope separation can have some interesting implications just for the development of science. And particularly in the second panel today, we've heard quite a lot of how those might work. And with that, I'd just like to thank you all for listening. Thank you for staying here all day and for listening to us talk away. And I look forward to some questions.
Thank you very much, James. I was particularly struck about the homemade laser capability that's out in the world. I was fortunate to do a postdoc in a French laboratory, and they drew it to my attention that you could actually use whiskey to make a laser system, which is a very... Maybe it says something about French health and safety. I mean, how did they find it out? Okay. I make the time 20 to 5. That means we have 35 minutes for questions. So I'd like to throw it open to the floor.
Very interesting, the discussion about self-protecting levels of radiation. And maybe we wondered if not just the panel members, but maybe some of the speakers this morning might want to comment, because our current categorization of nuclear facilities relies upon self-protecting, I believe, for spent fuels.
There was a quote from a previous presentation. I've forgotten whose it was, but it was a quote that said, you've got to do what's safe rather than what's cheapest. And the safest definition of self-protection is the 100 gray per hour limit. So I understand that could be problematic, but then what do we want to be? Do we want to be safe or do we want to be cheap?
Do we have a view from the floor on that, Roger? Would you have a view at all?
To be honest, this Generation 4 stuff we were getting involved with some years ago, but it was so far off, we decided to cancel the involvement in it. But it seems to me that that what we've just heard, that we've got to do what's right rather than what's cheapest, and so I'd be inclined to go down that path as well if I was still in the driving seat.
And alternatively, you just don't rely on self-protection, so you enhance physical protection methods and rely on those instead.
Matthew, do you want to come in?
There's some comments from other people I've spoken to have said that when it comes to Generation 4 systems in particular, that when it comes to reprocessing fuel, developing some of the technologies to be able to make fuel more self-protecting when you're transporting things to a reactor which have got high concentrations of 239 in the fuel, that the development costs in itself could just render the whole nuclear process completely and utterly unviable. And that's obviously just licking your finger and holding it up to the wind, but there's a lot of people that think that, and no one really knows how much it would cost to develop these technologies, how much it costs to then start to transport these materials, and then if you start to do things like involve curium into your fuel, if anyone knows about it, it's a spontaneous neutron emitter, then you have to shield everything and make everything work remotely, which becomes very expensive and very hard, and then if something breaks, you've got decades of machines not working, you have to decontaminate it, it just becomes almost completely unviable. So what are you supposed to do? I have no idea.
Gentleman with the red tie there.
Stephen Ashley, University of Cambridge. Firstly, to redact my previous statement on the assemblies, after a little bit of time and thinking, it would be that'd be for a 5 kilogram sphere, the 130 millisieverts to 380 millisieverts. So it depends really. A good part is dependent on the amount and size of the material you have in your assembly. So for a PWR assembly, which would have around about 500 kilograms, then it'd be about 13 sieverts per hour or so. So to correct that. So that then falls into two parts. The first part is, firstly, it depends on the amount of material which you are needing in your reactor as such. So if you have, a PWR, which has a large amount of material, an assembly which is quite difficult to move, if you compare that to, say, a CANDU bundle or another assembly which is much more smaller to handle, or, say, in the VHTR, if you have a small fuel element, then it's also dependent on the amount of material in a specific location. And the other question which I have is, we have different gradings for plutonium, going from weapons-grade plutonium to reactor-grade deep burn plutonium and so forth. And for low-enriched uranium and high-enriched uranium, the cutoff is 20% for uranium-235. So the question comes is that for plutonium, are there any better ways of actually trying to grade down, or at least looking at, say, the content of plutonium-238, plutonium-240 and so forth, to be actually have a much more finer grading of the different materials, which then affects very much on how the fuel cycles will run?
In particular, I know this isn't really answering your question properly at all, but with plutonium, the Astrid reactor in France, they're designed not to use radial breeder blankets, and the idea being that when they take fuel out of the reactor and taking their breeding components out of the reactor, the isotopics aren't quite the same. I'm not sure exactly on the isotopics. I've got a friend at NNL who's been doing some work looking at things in this respect, but I think the idea is that it's kind of taboo to use radial breeders in fast reactors because of this the sheer volume of plutonium you produce and how great it is for weapons. There's a fantastic quote by a French major who said that he supports the Super Phoenix project because it produced such brilliant quality plutonium. And I think a lot of things with Astrid are trying to get around these issues. Quite how good they are, I don't know, but maybe a finer grading would be more important to try and require much higher quantities that need to be diverted so there's a much greater timescale before you can detect it. When it comes to adding other things in, say, tweaking it by adding in americium or other components, that's almost negligible because you can just extract those out, which is something most countries are good at. So in terms of being able to regulate that and looking at the interest in the plutonium isotopics, that's a possibility. But then anybody could really get hold of one of these reactors and start sticking stuff around the outside in radial breeders and do it differently. So how you then stop a country doing this overtly, I have no idea.
So how many questions were there? There was just one question, right? Plutonium isotopics. Well, the Royal Society report points to spiking as a potential barrier, so that will, you know, change your plutonium isotopics and reduce the 239 content. And sure, there are things like that you can do, but you'd never get to a stage where you wouldn't apply all the other barriers and all the other, you know, security measures. So it's something you can do to help, but the primary, you know, the primary barriers would be elsewhere. I mean, you wouldn't want a non-state actor getting hold of, you know, super reactor grade plutonium or you know, anything far, you know, so far away from the weapon grade. It's nearly not usable. You just wouldn't want them to. So again, it's something that could aid proliferation resistance, but you wouldn't ever rely on it, if that makes sense.
Okay, more questions. The gentleman there. Okay.
Yeah, Robin Pittman, I'm from wherever I was from this morning. Mr. Chairman, we're at the end of the day now, and we're just about to go and have our dinner and some drinks. I wondered if I might crave your indulgence and let us reflect on broader issues that might cover the things that we've been talking about today. So we've been talking about the future and security and policy. And I think what I've heard is lots of fascinating detail, but that if we keep doing more and more of the same, probably we'll be okay, but we can't be sure. And somebody asked, well, can't we get in front, do something to get in front? And we've heard, too, that we don't know what we don't know, and there's a lot of smart people out there. I just wonder whether the big policy issue isn't, when the thing happens, what actually are we going to do? It seems to me we're going to be in a position like 9/11, cubed, quadrupled. The time to start thinking about what we do then isn't then, when the testosterone start inflowing big time, but before. Because what we do then, immediately afterwards, is going to set the direction for us as a world for the next 100 years, probably. So I would just like to know whether there's anybody around that are actually thinking about these kinds of questions.
Is your belief that the implications were such an event to happen to be so shocking that we don't want to consider it, therefore that's why we're...
I think that's it. I think it's much... it's much, much easier to do more of what we're doing. We're comfortable, I don't wish to be rude, but cranking handles and doing spreadsheets. This is a really, really difficult question. And this is actually one way we could get in front. And possibly the fact that we've worked out some of these answers, if we can, and made those public, might be actually a part of deterrence against the people who are actually intending to do these things.
That's a fantastic point. We have 25 minutes only to answer that. So if somebody has got an answer, please can they be brief? Who wants to?
You. I'll take a brief stab at it. But I mean, the first thing I would point out is that you can plan for an unfortunate event, but it's just knowing that those plans are still going to be relevant once it actually happens. It could well be that, you know, the greatest laid plans of mice and men and whatnot. I think you're very right to point out that we can spend a lot of time abstracting these topics. I think that when nuclear weapons were first brought into the world, they thought very carefully about exactly what would happen and exactly how you would act and how that might impact on deterrence. But now that, you know, the memory has faded somewhat, I think it's quite easy for us to sit around and talk about these things in a rather abstract level. But unfortunately, I find it quite hard to imagine that situation coming around now. So it's quite hard for me to actually plan very carefully for what we would do if everything were to go wrong, because as far as I can tell, things have gone okay so far. That would be my kind of tuppence on this.
I think the only other point that I'd add to that is that we've got a lot of hazards around on our nuclear sites here, and we're putting a lot of effort into trying to remove them. If you get rid of the hazard, then that's a lot of the worry has gone. And it's not as though we're starting from a clean sheet now. We are where we are. And I think it's important we put the effort onto removing those hazards which we know are there and we should be putting the effort into. I think it's long past the time when we should have gripped this, and I'm delighted that we're seeing that through the NDA now.
Does anybody else want to come back on that particular point? Because I know we've got a question with the gentleman over here. If not, Bill. Okay, thanks, Bill.
Sort of carrying on the theme of the last two comments. Now, here in the United Kingdom, there was a lot of interest a few years ago with the death of the last Tommy, the last person who had a personal recollection of the First World War trenches. It's not going to be too many decades before the last person on planet Earth who saw an airburst of a nuclear weapon or above ground detonation of a nuclear weapon, you know, leaves this planet, and then we're left with no memory of it in terms of visceral experience.
Okay.
So,
Dave, David, do you want to wait for the microphone? I think it's you, David. I'm not sure I can hear you.
I think probably most people heard that. it's a question that people keep coming back to, and it plays to what Bill just said. People are no longer have the memory that perhaps people grew up with and duck for cover and hide underneath your kitchen table and all that sort of stuff that people did at the height of the Cold War because they remembered how bad weapons were. Now, is it time to remind people? Should we do a controlled atmospheric test? You know, a five-nation test or something? Discuss.
Whoa.
Can we put that question to AWE, please?
There would be a number of issues, I suspect, that might happen. I'll see if I can respond to this. Thank you, David. I will buy you a drink. That's what we normally do when we think about Armageddon, is we say, oh, sod it, let's just go to the bar afterwards. So what's the premise? So your premise is that to remind people of how horrific nuclear weapon detonations can be, we should do a controlled nuclear test somewhere. Yeah. Right, okay. Just purely for the purpose of reminding people of the horrors of a nuclear warhead. Because there are other weapons of mass destruction that can also be used to kill people. Well, I'm glad you haven't actually got any plans.
I've got this now. I think that linking nuclear weapons with chemical and biological in weapons of mass destruction was an absolute mega mistake, because what it's done is to smooth over or make it look as though somehow nuclear weapons are in the same bracket. I grant that things like plague can be fairly damaging, but if you've seen a nuclear explosion, I actually haven't, but I've seen plenty of the records of it, this is something else again. That's thing one. Thing two is that actually, if there were a few of the guys who are talking about nuclear treaties, we've looked at all these international things where there are gentlemen's agreements and where everybody's, all sorts of people are doing their own thing. It might well be that it focuses people's minds and actually gets them to sit down and say, listen, we can't do this anymore. We really, really do need to make a serious attempt to try and get this fixed.
Gentleman on the first table here.
Tim Courtney, Lloyd's Register. I was lucky enough to be out in Japan last year looking at one of their nuclear power stations. And I suggest that if you were to go and talk to the people of Japan, as I did, and see their opinion of what a hydrogen explosion can do on a nuclear power station, I think very few of the public in Japan are supportive of nuclear power because of the mistrust. You only have to look at their attitude to see what it might do if you had an airborne explosion of a nuclear weapon. I don't think you need to go to that extent. I'm sure we're all agreed you don't need to.
I think that's actually quite interesting, because clearly the Southeast Asia region and the potential impact of North Korea, there is actually the generation of a nuclear debate within Japan with regards to nuclear weapons in a way that there never has been. So that's quite interesting, maybe the bipolarisation of Japanese society, that you have a population who, from what you're saying, would be very, might be anti civil nuclear power, but yet you have people who are getting closer and closer to government who are actually considering a weapons program potentially. So that's an interesting point.
Well, they're now in the situation where they are having to switch on their reactors, or they will be within the next year or so, because they're running short of power. Sorry, I was going to come on to the point that it's an interesting dichotomy that actually Fukushima has had two effects. One, in Japan, people are not particularly supportive of nuclear power because they're not trusting. But around the rest of the world, the UK, for example, it hasn't really changed the public perception of nuclear power at all, I believe.
If you want to come in on this, please let us know.
You may say that about the public perception in Japan, but I was in southern Japan last June, early June, when their summer, which is much nastier than our summer, started. Kansai Electric had turned off their reactors because they were told they had to. And there was a public debate, a very vigorous public debate about, do we have enough power for air conditioning, or do we keep the nuclear reactors off? And there were demonstrations in the streets, and the television and the radio was full of it. And in the end, they decided they wanted the power for the air conditioning. And that was a public vote, and they decided to turn the reactors back on again to allow Kansai Electric to provide enough power. So I'm not sure that if push comes to shove, even the Japanese will stick to their anti-nuclear.
I just wanted to kind of make a quick point on these various other points that have been made. And one problem is, and why we talk about proliferation resistance and proliferation risk all the time, is that we're not necessarily dealing with states that have had any memory or any institutional memory about how nuclear works. Japan is obviously a different case, and that's a highly special case. It has a very poor history with nuclear in general. But really, we talk about nuclear non-proliferation and export controls and proliferation risks and the non-proliferation treaty for the states that don't have any memory at all and weren't even really part of the Cold War, apart from possibly as proxies. In particular, it's useful to look at the Middle East, where their main exposure towards weapons of mass destruction hasn't been ducking under the table, or it hasn't been, you know, huge public campaigns. It's basically been watching two different regional leaders, one of which was deposed under the suspicion of a WMD campaign, and some might argue that the second was deposed because he decided to abandon his WMD, or partially abandon his WMD campaign. So while it's very important for us in the UK and for people in Japan to reflect on their kind of nuclear history, We're mostly concerned with people that don't have a nuclear history and are looking to get one fairly soon.
OK, there was the gentleman there. You had a question about 10 minutes ago. Oh, OK, sorry.
I've actually got a different question. Sam Inderhay's Rolls-Royce submarines. Just following on from the discussion we just had, one thing that's interested me a lot is how, as we were just saying, the public perception of nuclear post-Fukushima has changed quite little in the UK. And in fact, I've read some studies that have said it's improved for some reason. But then you look just very very closely in world terms at Germany, and their reaction has been very different. And I was just wondering if anyone on the floor really had any views as to why that was, why the specific German situation was very different from the UK's and perhaps France's, I'm not sure.
It's mostly politics. Just an anecdote, really, for you. After the day after the announcement had been made, I was driving in my German-built car with a very good German friend who was involved in the uranium enrichment business, and he was saying how odd he thought this decision was. And I said, well, look at it this way. We all want to buy your cars, and you'll find a string of nuclear power stations springing up along your border to sell you electricity, so we can use your money buying the electricity to buy your cars. And so I think it's just politics. They've got a very difficult political balance to play within Germany, and that's where it's coming from.
OK. Right. I'm going to abuse my prerogative as a chair, then. I'm going to just throw in a question. We talk about proliferation of nuclear technology and not wanting to do that, but are there cases that we should actively proliferate nuclear technology with regards to nuclear safety? If we have a state who has an illicit or an ambiguous nuclear program, should we somehow conspire to let them have a minimum level of safety technology? After all, the consequences of unsafe nuclear processes do not respect national boundaries.
Shall I?
Anyone?
Shall I start? Sure. I think that's a very good point. I think that's something that we've seen throughout the presentations today, particularly in the security presentations, that there's a bit of a tension, really, between trying to restrict and trying to encourage in this world. And I think that it's a good idea. It's something that we tackle with a lot of the time, though, is that where does it stop? You can kind of necessarily say that a certain level of safety technology could be, you know, the correct type of valves or the correct expertise, the correct training. But you could also say, well, actually, it's probably a lot safer, really, for you just to have one of our modular reactors, because we've tested those 1,000 times and we know those are the safest things. So you would have to define very carefully what, you know, what you're really trying to achieve, what level of safety you're trying to achieve, why, and where you would draw the line. And I think that that's what we face in terms of export control, it's what you face in terms of nuclear security, and it's what you face in nuclear safety. It's a very important point to raise, but I feel like the two, you know, forces that interact in these things aren't really resolvable in any way.
Chris Edwards.
Yeah. Just a comment on your question. I guess it depends on the perception of risk, whether the most likely event is a catastrophe through the operation of a legitimate plant by an inexperienced operator or by terrorist activity. And recent history would suggest that there's been more damage done by inappropriate operation of a licensed facility than through terrorist action. Okay. Had Fukushima been caused not by Mother Nature but by a terrorist, then the balance may well have been different, of course.
Okay. I have another comment on that, sure.
That's something I find very strange with the Iran situation. People seem to have gone a lot after their enrichment program for the production of weapons material, but a lot of the concern that I've not really seen much in the news has been over their nuclear power plant they operate, which is very understaffed, built on a fault line, and was produced by three different companies at different times, I think. And this is something that's actually more of a risk, I imagine, to the area than Iran's program at the time, probably, the present times, probably. So I wonder whether people are looking at the wrong aspects.
Could I weigh in on that very good point, actually? It's something that is starting to become more and more and more of a factor in a lot of the discussions in terms of Iran, mainly because of their Arak reactor coming online. But a lot of people have been noticing that now that their power reactor is online, that it is, as you say, not exactly the safest piece of kit. When they first brought it up online, a few months in, they had to pull the core out because of safety reasons. And it turns out that there were nuts and bolts and bits of kit actually lying in the containment vessel that they hadn't cleared out. And it is a very, very important thing to consider. And it's something that I've seen being mooted in various kind of hypothetical negotiation packages with Iran, in that you would get Russia back in and you would allow them to expand necessarily the work that they've done, go back and paper over the cracks, as it were, or at least, well, try and fill in the cracks, maybe not paper them in. But it's a very good point, and it's something that people are thinking about now.
I'll be filled with confidence that even in Iran we can't get a good plumber. Right, well, if we have no more questions from the floor, I would like to thank all three panel members for some very interesting presentations, which actually has provoked a much wider debate than we've had maybe the rest of the day. So thank you very much indeed.